Welcome back to Toys on Tap. This week is another good week. This is episode 2 of 3 with MVH, Mutant Vinyl Hardcore. He comes on, talks about all kinds of cool stuff in his history and really building out the brand and the toy landscape for Mutant Vinyl Hardcore. If you want more Toys on Tap, you can follow us on all socials at Toys on Tap. If you want to support the show in a free way, you can like, subscribe, rate, review, wherever you get podcasts. It means the world to us, and it costs you $0. So please, please, please rate, review. More people can hear it. If you want to support the show even more, patreon.com/toysontap. We're going to start putting these up earlier as we get more people coming on for the podcast. You can now see these videos and these interviews on YouTube, which we're really excited for, and they seem to be doing well. So I'm pumped that this is now on YouTube, full interviews, fully edited, and all those kinds of things. So let's get to this week's episode of Toys on Tap. I'm pumped. This is episode 2. Thanks for working with me on time and all that stuff.
Nah, dude, thank you. I mean, I'm a little tired. I've been doing some, since I got back from Japan, I've been doing some this cleanup work around the house, spring cleaning, you know, as of the season breaks. So, maybe I must have did, I don't know, 10 runs to the dump, dropping. So this whole week has just been a lot of cleanup, and it's been a long day. So,
dude, cooked. I can't imagine. Yeah. I can't imagine going through, you spend a month and fully acclimate to a new place, a new climate, mm-hmm. a new everything.
Yep.
And then come back and still have to do life.
Oh yeah, not just I come back and it's like, all right, you've been gone for a month, so we got a lot to get caught up on immediately, you know? So it's a learning curve, that's for sure. I mean, it's doable, but it's just all right, now I know for next time what to get accomplished before I leave. This way, I don't want, right now I'm coming back cleaning up, so hopefully next time I go, I know all right, before I leave, make sure you have all these things lined up and done. I mean, you can have all the bills paid, but it's still not gonna, handle other things. Here in the Northeast, we got so much snow this winter time that, making sure that I had somebody on call while I'm not around to do it myself was something I didn't even think about until I was getting ready to leave. I'm like, oh no, I'm gonna be here. And then, of course, we had 3 snowstorms. So, I mean, it is what it is, but it's just a learning thing. I mean, but it is tiring.
Yeah.
But rewarding, you know how it goes.
Because you will go back. We know this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the thing. When I go back next time, I want to take my entire family. That's the goal is to...
Okay.
I want to try to do every year, stay in Japan for 3 times a year, 1 month each. So... probably 3 months.
Going to Japan 3 times a year for a month each is going to be insanely cool. Because I know that the eventual goal, at least from what you've been posting about, is that you want to go there and stay there.
Yeah. Yeah. I would like to at some point buy a house out there and just when the kids get older, my youngest is going to be 8. So over the course of the next, 10 years, I have his spot where I can go there for long periods and then have my kids able to come when they want, come and go as they want. I mean, for Americans, we could stay out there for 3 months in a row without having to worry about any kind of visa or any issues like that. So it's definitely well in the possibility of doing.
That's cool. I love that so much. Hey, this is episode 2 of 3 for MVH, and I'm pumped. Usually people get scared off when I propose multi-episode things, but for some reason you said, yeah. So, and this is really the growth and making of the MVH brand, which I'm really excited for. And so even though we heard it last episode, got to reintroduce yourself, tell us who you are and what you do.
Name is Rich Montaneri. I am the owner of Mutant Vinyl Hardcore, Toyko. You see it. I'm the one that's behind it.
Heck yeah. So we, as we did last episode, we kind of left off right as you're beginning your toy making career and you are doing this Sludge Demon and the way that you kind of explain it is like you're working with forms rather than like anatomically correct things. So like this bump can be the essence of an arm, or this could be a leg, and it shows in the work. And so we're going to start, I think, right back there. So you just get this influx of Sludge Demon shipped to your house. What was next for you?
Just trying to figure out how to utilize it to its maximum capacity. You know what I mean? So like, how do I get the most out of this? So I can, cause who knows when the next order is going to come in. So how do I, you know, again, like I think I said before about not, I was painting runs to match the size of people that ordered them. Right. Instead of just painting like 50 and then hoping and praying that they all sell. So that was like that was the first way of like, all right, this is the way to try to make this last. That was really it. Just trying to get, now that I have stuff in hand, how do I get from order to order? You know, how do I make each batch last long enough that I don't have to worry about running out and then having nothing at hand? And it worked out pretty well. You know, like it definitely, you know, worked out pretty well doing that.
I mean, the hard part is like you're just dipping your toe in. And we talked earlier about the reality of having to buy hundreds. Is it overwhelming as your first toy to get a couple hundred different colorways, especially in these early years where you're trying to figure out, like, how do I even sell these to people?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, it sounds like it's a lot, but it's not. I mean, again, it was only you had glow, black, flesh, clear, and you could just, you know, it wasn't even expensive then either. I mean, I think I was paying maybe $10 a blank. I mean, that price has exploded astronomically since then, and that's just the way of the world. But no, man, like the cost per piece wasn't really that bad. So you're looking at a couple grand, and this is like, it sounds more than what it was. And it's just like having that is good and all. So it wasn't overwhelming. It wasn't like, what am I going to do all these things? It was just like, just knowing that I had stock was comforting. And it gave me like the sigh of relief, like, all right, I have a baseline now, you know?
Yeah. Man, $10 a blank is so cheap. I'm looking around and the toys that we've made haven't even come close to that. We made the little claw and I think that was still like $9.
Oh yeah. I mean like I mean this is in Japanese vinyl too, which is by far the most expensive vinyl you can buy. I mean it's up there. And nowadays now it's far more than that, and especially like when you start going to like larger size toys and stuff, man, it's like the margin gets shorter and shorter. And like, you know, this can bring up an interesting topic too about like, you know, there is like a ceiling on what collectors are willing to spend on things, which kind of makes the artist have to make some choices on like, how do I want to approach this? Do I want to approach this as art, or don't approach this as toys, you know? And like, if you're approaching it as toys, where it's just like, they're not anything more special than toys, then you don't want to put all this super extra effort into, you know, treating it as art, because the payoff isn't there, right? You've spent so many hours making something and like, you would be getting paid almost nothing per hour per piece. So it just, you know, there does present like that line in the sand where you got to make a choice here. What are you doing with this? Otherwise you can easily, you know, it would cost more to make them than you actually did to sell them, and that starts going in the negative, and you don't want to do that.
Yeah. I think let's open this price can of worms. That is the number one thing I deal with any artist that asks about making toys. And I mean, you have the people that have been in the toy community or making toys the longest, of course, they have higher prices. Like that, you're paying for years of skill and notoriety and name and like cool factor. Like you see these toys that Groman makes, and they're like $1,500 a piece. I've seen some pretty hefty soft vinyl price tags out. And so there is a ceiling. So this starting out though, you're not approaching that. So now, like, how are you navigating that? Because you still have to care for your family and stuff.
Well, that's the thing, man. I mean, when you are doing this as a hobby, then you can kind of, it's not something you need to focus on, right? As long as you make enough money to break even, then it's good. But once you cross over that line into being a full-time artist doing this, then you have to really start paying attention to everything, because now you have the government looking for their tax money. You know what I mean? So like, you have to look into everything becomes a thing now. It's no longer a hobby, it's a job, and you have to approach it as a business, you know, like, this is a business. Like, there is the art aspect of it, and then there's the business aspect of it. And you have to learn to be an adult and separate these two things and acknowledge that this is reality here. We all, you know, in a perfect world, you wouldn't have to worry about these things, but, you know, this is reality. And this, once it becomes your job, you should treat it as such. You know what I mean? There's multiple ways of approaching this. You know, some, you know, artists and collectors are diehard, where this is there's a finite number that you should never cross, and to them that's that, and they will work within that, and that's great. And then there's other you know philosophies or trains of thought where other people are like, no, this is art and it can have no ceiling to it. You know, like with me, I try to approach it from all these angles, you know. So, I mean, there's, you know, the one-off aspect where, you know, I'm trying to push that into the fine arts. There's the production stuff where it's 100% made through a factory where I have nothing involved besides being the director of it. I'm like, you know, saying, hey, this color here, there, and directing it. And then, you know, which would, you know, significantly lower the cost, because then we're going to be doing a larger size run. And again, it's not hand-painted, it's factory-painted. Then there's in the middle where you have, you know, I could do micro runs, which again would be, you know, technically a painted run, but they're smaller batch hand painted by me. There's blanks. This topic is so dense, and I've had it with so many toy makers, and it really just comes down to what they want to do. And then you have to kind of pick what you're looking to do, and then just straight up ignore all the noise that comes with it. There will always be somebody out there telling you, you're wrong, right? Like, this is not how it's supposed to be. Like, that's and the people that have that opinion where they have to make everybody around them have the same opinion as them is ridiculous. So you have to treat how you want to do something, and then just ignore either other makers, fans, whatever you want to be, and just focus on the people that do understand it and do get what you're trying to accomplish, and then go from there. You know, this is how it is. And, you know, the way I looked at it too is that, you know, with every job you have, you know, if you're working for somebody else, you're going to be eventually looking for some kind of, you know, position changes or raises, however you want to approach it. When you're working for yourself, you have to be the one that gives you your own raise and your position change. Like, there's nobody doing it for you. You're doing it yourself. So I think as long as you give people the quality that the price demands are asking, then everything is okay. If you're asking for a price that's not worth it, then that's when you have a problem, right? So just, you know, studying the work around you, you got to pay attention to everything, and then you'll kind of have a good understanding of what should cost what, and, you know, what is fair to people. I mean, there's a fine line, but there is a line. And as long as your fans are happy and you can make a living doing this, and then you're okay. And you would just straight up have to ignore anybody that complains on either the production side or the fan side. And then you just have to learn how to live with that.
Yeah. I think the two things that I always come back to is, like, of course you got to look around, you got to figure out what things are priced, like, do whatever research you got to do. But also, like, no one, you shouldn't be taking advice from people that haven't done what you're doing, or they haven't, like, put in the work, or they're not currently doing the exact same project. Because in toys, every project is different. Every single thing is different. Yeah.
I mean, like, even, like, say I, you know, me personally, right? I have the same, let's say, vinyl factory. Let's say, Maruyama in Japan. I have the same middleman, the same factory, same everything. But every toy has to be, like, assessed, right? How much does this one particular piece cost to make? What am I trying to accomplish with it? Like, you have to go down the laundry list of all of these questions that what you're looking to do with this one particular thing. It could be the same factory, the same vinyl, same everything, but your one thing you might just be approaching it as, I just want to use this as one-offs or micro runs. And this other thing, I'm going to try to sell, you know, blanks and have spray masks made, and I can make more of it. So, like, it could be the same production house, same thing, but you have to approach it completely different. So, like, every single project has to be addressed piece by piece.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, you have the Sludge Demon. This is here. You're doing runs, micro runs, all the things that you do that we now know you for. But this kind of starts something in you, because we see the progression in which you are producing character after character. So kind of line me up. Set this up for what it does for your next thing, because this isn't full time at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. Like because there is a standard size, especially for Japanese toys, and that's usually the 8 to 9 inch range. That's what is considered standard size. When you go back to like vintage toys, that's standard size. So when you're designing a toy, you're trying to, you know, make something that's original, but you also want to have a shelf of other makers' toys. Like, you want to fit in too. You don't want to have this thing where it's just this, you know, eyesore that's kind of sticks out. So you got to try to design within parameters, you know? So as, you know, yes, I made a toy that was very simple design. It can kind of fit in with anywhere. Then it's like, all right, so the next step is, let's try to make something that's a little more complex that gets a little bit bigger, right? What happened with me was it wasn't by plan, but it was, again, another one of those happy accidents where I was hired, you know, I hired somebody out here, a tattoo artist, again, I talked about trying to help me sculpt something, and which that failed. I had Ricky Velocitron. He was also starting a toy for me because he was a sculptor too. So I had him start on something, and as the guy here failed, he kind of took over. And then when he kind of failed or got caught up, I had him send what he started to me. And after I had like the confidence from the Sludge Demon, I transitioned that confidence and saying, all right, I took what Ricky was started and I can just, you know, I can take it from there. So that's when, like, he started, like, the legs and the body was what he kind of started. I took it here, and it was just this massive toy. It was way larger than what I asked for. And it was like, I didn't have the confidence then yet to start from complete from scratch. So I was like, I'm just going to have to take what he gave me, which was legs and a torso, and then I'm going to have to just ride with that. So within that scale, it ended up being like 13 and a half inches tall, which was this giant, right? I was like, all right, well, I went from being this small toy to this fucking giant. But I still was like, all right, let me try to keep it in simple, you know, the most simple term that I can get it. So I kept, again, just the legs, the torso, left arm, right arm, head, right? So it's still pretty simple in design aspect. So even though it was tall, it was still very, very, it didn't have moving legs. This way, I didn't have to worry about the mechanics of that. Just fixed leg, static torso, then the arms and the head. So size-wise wasn't what I wanted, you know, but everything else kind of worked. I adjusted everything I needed to adjust, and I added on to it. And then that's how I ended up making the Ali toy. So that's how I got there. So, but the thing was, like, I have like this little guy and this giant fucking toy. I still haven't hit that sweet standard size spot, and I kind of honestly never really did even to this day. Like, I tried but like to this day, like I'm constantly like juggling, like there. I just can't dial it in. So I kind of gave up on that. I mean, so I kind of got to the point where it's like,
yeah,
I'm just going to have to make my own things and make the collection of my own and then have whatever else they collect. Then they're going to have to figure that out. I mean, like I'll get close, you know, like absolutely. I'm going to get close to standard size, but like, it's going to be, you know, you're going to have to, some of my collectors are going to have to really like, they're going to have to focus on my own collection of the MVH brand that will make its own collection and then we'll fit it all in. So yeah, even though I'm giving you advice, like, yeah, stick to standard size, I kind of just fucking totally didn't take my own advice and did everything on my own.
Yeah. I mean, that's what makes it so that you can give the advice because you've done the outside of it, right?
Yeah.
I do. Can we pause for a second? And sure. This is the second time that Velocitron has come up. Is this someone that still exists? Because I've told you before that I've heard about him through other people. Does this person still exist in the toy scene?
No, not at all. No, not at all. Like, I mean, again, there was, I'm still going back to like 2010 to 15. You know, he was, you know, he was the only one, like his apprentice, Science Patrol, Corey, was then the person that ended up taking over for him. So, but Ricky Velocitron, yeah, like he, as he started taking on American clients, he took on some, you know, too much work, right? And I don't know all the details, but I do know that it got way out of control. There was a lot of money lost. And then he eventually ended up just not disappearing, but like he was managing some kind of like Japanese baby girl punk metal band. I know minimal about it. I don't know what happened to him. I haven't spoken to him in probably 8 years, if not more. I mean, so like who really, like you'll come to learn that it happens a lot out there. I mean, like you'll have people that will come and go. Mm-hmm. So I formed some good relationships. You know, again, with everybody that's come into my life, you know, especially if you've been, you know, very, I don't want to say helpful, but you've been like a big part of my life. I mean, I always will feel some kind of gratitude toward you. And I'm not going to bad talk you. So again, I know he's had his problems with other people, but he definitely gave me my career. So I will always feel some kind of debt to him for that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's helpful just to, because he almost sounds like an elusive ghost, because people,
very much,
they talk about him as this intermediary, but then all of a sudden, after a certain period, he's gone. So that's good to know.
Yeah.
So the toys that you're making, you all of a sudden spike 13-something inches, which it does a couple things. One, it stands out. It doesn't accomplish the size thing that you'd like to do with the Japanese standard. And then it also takes up different shelf space than what your sludge would have taken up. Here we go. This is what I know you are waiting to hear, project updates on the things that we've got going on with Toys on Tap. Firstly, we got two new claw colorways that we are so excited for. We're doing an amazing like blue gray look one, and so we're really excited about that. And then we're bringing the OG colorway with the green and the yellow nails. We thought that those two would be really cool. When they come in, 25 will go online and the other 50 of each will just go at the shows, and that's where you will have to get them. We still have some of the other ones. I think they're sold out online, but if you missed your chance, you will see them at conventions. So we're really excited. Queso Jones ships this week. I'm really excited to have that. We've been waiting a long time. It's been a long process, but we are so excited. The packaging is here. We are just waiting for the toy, and then my wife and I will be cracking into shipping, and you will get those. The last KMB is in the middle of production. They are starting to pull the vinyl, which we're really excited about. Stay tuned on that. We will have more updates coming. And our next Kickstarter that will launch with our friends over at Depressed Monsters, Mr. Ryan, we are so pumped to bring the first ever Yearman soft vinyl toy to life. We cannot believe that we get to partner with an artist that we absolutely look up to. So if you want to stay up on any of those things, what we're doing, that's what's going on with Toys on Tap. You can follow. We have a newsletter and there's updates on the Instagram and all kinds of good stuff. So thank you. Thank you for all the support.
Well, yeah. Well, the thing is, like, I kind of looked at it all as a footprint on a shelf. You have, like, we'll say, like, Godzilla has a tail, and that's going to take up a lot of shelf space, right? Like, it has the footprint is massive. So it wasn't really, like, height-wise. And, like, I was at least, at that time, the IKEA Detolf was, like, the last case that everybody had for their displays. It was cheap. Everybody got it. So as long as it fit within that shelf, I was like, all right, this can still work. It fit within the shelf. I'm like, and the footprint was, you know, it wasn't very dense on the shelf. So you can have them side by side and it could possibly go on the back of a shelf and you could have your other works in front of it and, you know, stacked downwards. And at least it could take up the back row if you just wanted to have it with your other works. But it did, the foot space, the footprint didn't take up this massive shelf space. It's just taller, but it didn't take up a lot of density in a shelf. So that was the advantage to that, which worked out.
Yeah. You know, we're playing with that now. We have one that's about to ship to us and it's 8 inches tall. We've kind of tried to stay with that 8 inch. And so it's good to know that that's the standard. And one we did was real fat. And so the legs may not have taken up a bunch of spots, but the body like bowed out. And then this one, it's just like a stick. So we're killing it.
Well, the only way to do it is to do it and then say, all right, well, this works and what this doesn't work. I mean, like, there's always going to be like these perfect examples out there and you try to strive to mimic them because, like, if they nailed it and then you don't have to reinvent the fucking wheel every time, you can just be like, hey, this guy's nailed it. There's a reason why this thing is so successful. Study it and see what you can get out of it to transition to your own works. You know what I mean? You don't have to be like this. Fast, where it's like, I can't do that because somebody else. If it's successful, then like there's a reason for that. You know, you don't have to, not everything has to be reinvented. You could just say, all right, this actually works. What can I do to contribute? I don't have to always be reinventing the wheel every time. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. So you start this whole process over then again. You got to send this sculpt off, it gets there. And then wait however long in this hit or miss market where it's like, it could be 2 months, could be 2 years. We'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. You get it back. You have two toys. You have now, like, it's almost like Mutant Vinyl Hardcore has entered the chat after two toys now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but I don't want to cut you off, but like still at that point, man, like Sifubi, like in America was, it's just now, like, it's catching on, but it's not like this big thing. I'm starting to get some traction with fans and my fans that know me from like the message boards, but I would still do conventions and I wouldn't sell out. I mean, like, you know, so it's there, but it's not like this massive success and hit off the bat, you know.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of those early conventions, because I know that a couple of the shows that I've been at and a couple of the things, like, I've seen pieces or you've hosted lotteries, but you're not there because you're busy. You got a whole life and family and all that stuff. So early on, you're going to these things. You're at them.
Yeah. I mean, New York Comic Con was, I mean, I've never been to San Diego Comic Con, but I did New York. Again, it's only about an hour and a half from here. We always go to the Javis Center, so it's easy to do. So I would do the New York Comic Con, and then eventually Designer Con, you know, was in, I'm going to say Pasadena was the original ones, but it was like those. So it was mostly just New York Comic Con, and then eventually going out to DCon. But those were like the first conventions I did. And I kind of was consistent with them. That was literally the only places. And then, you know, I had a couple of shows with Super 7, like I mentioned before, about one in San Francisco and one in Florida. But for the most part, it was just conventions. Mostly just New York Comic Con and then decon, then, you know, doing lotteries online in between. Like nowadays, yeah, like I, you know, there's so many more conventions and, you know, that I'm working with, say Unbox. I don't have to, I can't, my, that I don't have to, but I can't physically be at everything. So yeah, I'm definitely now getting to a point where there's times where I don't have to even be there. I can just have the, you know, somebody that's representing me handle it, you know, so I can do more.
Yeah. I think it's so important for new, especially new creators to hear this.
Yeah.
And new is really like 7 years and under.
Yeah.
So I'm still in that of like, you started doing the thing that we all did and we all are doing. And it is not until like probably pretty recently that we've said like, oh, I'm not going to everything. I'm going to work through all these different avenues instead. And I think that people sometimes try to jump the gun.
Yes.
But it takes time. It takes effort. It takes years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, this where I train jiu-jitsu, there's a somebody I train with. He goes by Show Your Teeth, and he's just starting out too. And I've had these conversations with him, and you know, we've hung out, and I'm trying to, you know, give him everything I can to knowledge-wise. I've been like, try this convention, do that, focus on this, focus on that. But like the end of the day, I mean, it really just boils down to like, does this person, how hungry, you know, how hungry are they? How much do they want it? What do they want to do? And if, but he is very, you know, into it and going to these conventions and doing it, that's what it really just comes down to, dude. Like, if you just got to keep going. I mean, there's the first few years, you're going to eat shit. I mean, that's just how it is.
Yeah.
If you can just, you know, push through and learn, you know, like your success rate will just go higher. Like there's no answer to this, right? Like sometimes you just win and sometimes you don't. Like I hit the lottery, so to speak, on having a fan base. I'm not any more special than anybody else. I have no clue why people collect my work more than anybody else. I just do the best I can. I show up, I try to treat all my, you know, my fans and customers like I would treat a family member, and then try to deliver on quality. So if I want to make sure that everybody that I interact with, you know, they feel like they left my presence, you know, like, oh, it was worth the time, money, and effort to come see this person and support them. And I think that that goes a long way as well. You know, like you don't want, you know, you can't just be dialing it in or not even going to these conventions or shaking some hands and talking to people, because all of this matters at the end of the day, you know?
Hey, you just tapped into something that's one of my biggest pet peeves with the like shaking hands and talking to people. If I go to another convention and someone is just sitting behind the table, not talking to people walking by, what are you doing?
I don't know, man. Like it's a learned skill for sure. Some people are more, comfortable with it. Some aren't. I think if you, in this day and age, you have to learn to be comfortable with it. And if you're not, you're going to have a long road ahead of you. You know, it's not that hard. People just want to have some acknowledgement. Some, you know, like it's really just that much. Like you said, like you walk by, just say, hey man, how you doing? That's, you don't have to have this whole deep conversation about life. You can just show them the basic respect of like, hey, how you doing? I see you. You know, that's really it. That's the most simplest thing you can do.
We are approaching and looking at your toys. You've caught the bug because you produced a second toy. And thank God that Japan at this time could potentially be a little slower. So it like slows people down intentionally. Quick after do you submit for the third toy?
That's definitely an interesting story. I told you I did a show with the Super 7 in Florida. And that was pretty much like I had used the Sledge Demon as, because it was the only toy I really had at the time. I was making that. And then I also peppered in, like, I had some M1 Go toys that I customized. But anyway, somebody, I have the to this day, but somebody took one of the one-offs that I bought. They burnt it to a crisp and sent it back to me in the mail as like, I'll go fuck yourself. And it was just, I didn't know what it was. I still have this. I've met every type of fam, right? You have good people. You have shitty people. You have people that are very supportive and people just want to, they will do anything in their power to try to set you back. And this is what it is.
Yeah.
That's just humanity. I don't know why people do what they do. Anyways, this person, I still don't know to this day who it was. Like, you know, like I looked at the name. I don't know. I still don't remember. But they sent me this legend that I painted up. Came back, was just burnt to a crisp. It was just, it looked like a charcoal brick. I have it in my collection, but I didn't know what it was. And I got it in my hand and I was looking at this thing. And at the time I was finally starting to get the confidence of doing a toy that had, you know, movable legs now and a torso, you know. And I was kind of lost what to do with it. And then once I got this piece in, I was like, man, it kind of just sparked the idea of what would be like if this toy that I got, the Sledge Demon, this charred up thing, came back to life in this next form. It kind of just evolved. Mm. And that became what is the Sledge Demon DX, which is now like my most popular toy. It was like, it's not a standard size toy, but it's right below standard size. And for the most part, I think it did well because of, you know, it being easily collectible, right? It's not this massive piece. It has more significance than a small toy, but it's not too big. You know, so you can have a whole lot of them. The texture I got from this charred up thing, I made it kind of resemble some of this texture, and I gave it the Death DX, the skull. Like, it was like these transitional like characters that went from this charred remain turning into a form now, you know? So that's how this second toy became to be. And again, following like the same, you know, design path as say Real Head or Seeker Base, where they had a body and then I can just make multiple heads to go with this. And that kind of was like the perfect, like I learned from the little one. I shot too big with the second one, was big, and I had help. This was the first actual toy that I did fully on my own, movable legs, movable arms, head. And then I had this, basically what was a hate mail turned into like the inspiration. Like, I didn't know where to go with this. And then boom, now I have this thing here where it's like, it kind of gave me like, oh, this is like the rebirth from that. This is like taking something that was supposed to be like this hate mail piece to tell me to go fuck myself and turning it into like the answer to where, you know, how to progress my line, you know? So it was taking something bad, turning it into something positive, and then making that toy that I can work with. So it kind of hit all the notes, and that's how I got to making the third toy.
I mean, it is absolutely bizarre to take a quick detour that someone would do that. Doesn't make any sense. Also, jokes on them. When you burn vinyl like that, it is one of the most toxic things in the world.
Yeah, it's not good. I mean, not good.
Idiots.
I don't know, man. Like,
I
find it interesting, man. I don't know. Like, in hindsight, again, I've met so many different people in this. I just find it interesting. Like you start to recognize a pattern in people. You know, like who's gonna be a problem? Who's gonna be cool? Who's like, they're not really gonna be a problem, but they're not gonna be around forever either. You know, like you start to like there are people you'll start to recognize these patterns in people.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a type of person, especially where we, I said that because like, as I was saying it out loud, I was getting flashes of people. There is a type of person, especially now that we work with artists to help make their toys come to life, that it's, you get ideas thrown at you and you have to, like, I'm nice and cordial to everyone, but there is a type of person that I just will not partake in. And now people listening to this are going to be like, am I that person? You're not.
You might be that person.
I promise.
No, you might be. No, I'm sorry. No, like if you're that person, that would give you the like, all right, I need to reevaluate myself and not be that person. So if yeah. you're thinking this is you, then you need to get your shit yeah. together and stop being that person.
It's challenging, but I mean, it is cool that spurred on the third toy, because at this point, yeah. you in this shift, which is cool, and you, like, you're articulating it, that like you did first toy, second toy, so you had two yeah. individuals, and now it's like, okay, we're closer to standard size, and okay. this is where we start doing the smart stuff of like same body, yes. different heads, smart, like yes. this is where we start yes. applying everything that we've learned.
Yes, yes, yes. Again, it takes time. I would say from the first. The mini Sludge Demon, Ollie, and then the DX, it happened pretty fast. I mean, again, I was submitting something new every, say, 6 months. We're looking at like a 2-year window yeah. where all these are getting made. But again, like with like everything I could mention about Japan, like you kind of just, while the going's good, you get going, right? So you're just submitting yeah, things. Yeah. And then it kind of like, from there, kind of slowed down somewhat, but I was able to have like, all right, I have these few things here, and that's when I was able to, you know, do more heads for the DX or create the Berserker for the Ollie body, and then that bought me a lot of time. So I would just, all right, we have these two toys I can actually work with here. Let's see how I can, you know, just, you know, reinterpret it by just changing up the head or a piece or that, and. That also like helps you be more creative and you know.
Yeah. And what's cool about, I mean, it's funny to see how the progression is. Like it's over a 2-year period, you're getting three toys made. So it's like every 6 months we're pumping something. Yeah,
now we're back.
I mean, working with like some of these Chinese factories, if I push hard, we're talking like 5-6 toys a year if I'm ramping. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And which I'm not doing. That's wild. But like,
it's tough.
They're just, yeah, they've just like upped their game or have sped up the process so much.
Yeah. 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 I mean, what I've found is like Japan is definitely super traditional, right? Like they have their ways. They're not changing them. Either you accept it or you don't. That's just what it is. There's upsides and there's downsides to that, right? You know, the China comes along, sees that there is a market here, and they were making toys, but like, you know, again, it wasn't the best quality, but now they've definitely upped their quality across the board. If it was just like one factor, I'd be like, oh, that's just a fluke. No, man, this factory after factory after factory, that they've then stepped their game up in every possible way. So it allows, you know, more people to come in. And I think competition is good. You know what I mean? Like if you have these factories that are able to, you know, make better production, that means everybody's got to be like, oh, I can't just sit here and make shitty things. So we want customers too. So they have to make better things. And there was for a long time too in China, you would get bootlegged a lot because it wasn't even like they would take copies, which I've had done my stuff, but they would have people that worked at the factory and would just be like, when nobody's looking, just pull some extra and then sell that. You know, like you had that. That's what Cause kind of started with the whole original fake stuff. It was like there was bootlegs after bootlegs. And then like he was like, I'm just going to not bootleg the bootlegger, but kind of just take their ideas and put my name on it. So like, it's very interesting. But again, as I'm derailing myself, the Japanese versus Chinese vinyl, like it's gotten closer for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you bring up that bootleg thing. I haven't had a factory issue with that, but the other day, a couple days ago, I had a shirt company in the US they're going to print shirts for me and homeboy on the phone either let it slip or something, but he said, yeah, there's a couple guys here that really love the design. They're each going to get one. And I said, excuse me? And he said, yeah, well, we print a couple extra just in case there's any flaws with it. And then we have those shirts. And it was like, you didn't even ask? Like, what the hell is that, dude? That's so crazy that you said that to me, especially with such full confidence. You dick.
Yeah. Again, this is my point about like the business stuff versus like the art stuff, right? You got to pay attention to this shit because it's like, if you're trying to build a brand, it's not necessarily like you're trying to, you know, be this micromanager, but like you got to have some consistency and control over what you're putting out there, right? So like however you're approaching this, you got to have that, you got to make sure you're on top of these things, because if you don't know this about this factory, things slip out the back door and it can get squirrely really fast. If you're making t-shirts and you want to become like a t-shirt brand or a clothing designer, you definitely can't have that happen. You know, if you're doing it for a hobby, that's it's not cool, but like it's not going to kill you. But like if they're doing that to you, they're doing it to the people that are really bringing in like big names and big business, and they're going to be ripping them off too. So who knows? Now that's to your point. Like if they're that confident, that's a huge red flag. Like, all right, I can't fuck with you because I can't trust you now.
Yeah, which has been like such a problematic thing working with Kevin. So now it's like I got to send a different email of like, hey man, I didn't like that comp. That wasn't great. That's not that, what that I like.
That's not good.
Yeah, it's whatever. So over the course of 2 years, you get these toys made, and then we start ramping up to do the next ones. But luckily, you have the bodies, so we're doing just swaps of the tops.
Yep.
So for the next like couple years, you have that going, and then you start bringing out other like your new characters. And I'm interested in this because from an outside perspective, they don't all look like they belong in the same world or that you are in the process of world building, but more that you're just building what you like and what you want.
Pretty much. I mean, like I said to you before, like there's some artists out there that are really good at world creating. I mean,
yeah.
And I, you know, when you're starting out, you're kind of all over the place of like what you're like. There's some artists out there that come out the gate and they have fucking, they're laser focused on what they're going to do. I wasn't that guy. Like I had so many inspirations, whether it be this guy, this artist, that artist. Like I was like, I would be kind of pulled in all these directions, you know, so I would make this toy. And then eventually, like, I'm at the point now where it's like, I gave up on the whole, like, if I have some kind of world building thing and it's cool, that's great. But I kind of looked at it as like the Tarantino approach where like everything kind of is in its own world, but kind of connect to the other worlds too. You know what I mean? So it doesn't necessarily have to be like this one particular world. I can just have a toy that's in here that can be connected to that by some little minor aspect of something that connects them together. So yeah, I started paying more attention to like, do I think this thing looks cool? That was my biggest thing. And like, do I like looking at it? Do I want it on my shelf? Does this thing look scary? Does this thing look a gamas? Like, whatever I'm approaching, that's it. It wasn't like, all right, man, this thing has to work, you know, in the world of this other toy. And so I have to make sure all these things fit. I didn't like having those parameters. You know, like I'm just going to make this thing because I like the way it looks. That was my biggest focus.
Let's say we're up to like 2016 now, and we're like full force still producing toys and stuff.
Yeah.
Popularity has grown. We have like social media has started coming in.
Yeah.
You're on the different social medias. It's making things easier.
Yeah.
What does that do to kind of change who you are as an artist? Because now you're able to reach fans quicker. They're here specifically for you because they're following you. They like you have an audience that like people forget that Instagram, you have an audience in your pocket. Use it.
Yeah,
and
totally.
So tell me about that, like that kind of evolution, like 2016-ish.
I don't know. I mean, I think still, you know, let's just take, you know, early social media days, like people still don't know what to make of it, right? Like, even let's say like Twitter, when Twitter first came out, people were like kind of using it and say, you know, like they didn't even know how to use it. Like they would just kind of say their handle and it's like eating pizza or eating a cheeseburger or like whatever it is. They would just feel like, so like, you know, like how do you like, or like on Instagram, you would again taking photos of your food or what, like nobody really had a clue what to do with the stuff. It was just like, you're out here using this and like, well, I know, like, you know, and then eventually that kind of, you know, rose to like the content creator where they would be more focused on selling products. And then that's when I would say social media kind of went in the direction of using it as this kind of, I don't want to say influencer, but like influencer is a good term because like they were influencing people to focus on this product, right? And they would focus on their one Instagram channel, one BuzzFeed, all kinds of random things. I think like you would have an Instagram where people would be taking photos of their day-to-day life, their food, their family, their pets, you name it. And then it kind of went to like, I'm making this Instagram for just this one thing and then focusing on that.
Yeah.
So over the years, it would kind of like, if you go back even to my earlier stuff, it was like, you know, like it was just random things. And then eventually you would just start, you find the flow of like, oh, this makes sense of where I'm going to go with this. But, you know, even back to the earlier stuff, I wasn't the most popular Instagram feed. It was just like, there wasn't a whole lot. There was, you know, you had people were starting to come online, but I was still relying on shows like, say, like Toy Art Gallery opened up their spot on Melrose. And I was still focused on doing shows. And that was, you know, that was probably more helpful than social media at the time. Social media only really kind of started kicking in again when the world kind of started waking up to it, right? Like for the longest time, there wasn't this massive fan base in, say, China or you name it, Singapore, Taiwan, go down the list, right? There wasn't this massive thing. So like you had history in Japan, you had history in the States, and it wasn't this massive thing yet. It was when I would say like China really started getting into collecting is when that opened up a whole other market of collectors. And then it just kept like a domino effect, country by country by country, you know, London, and then it would just a little bit of everywhere. And that's when like things started taking off. And then you would have like the rise of like the Sifubi celebrity, like let's say with Nag 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 or Hirota, but like you would have these Japanese guys that were like, you know, big names. And that again, they would start getting into more collaborations. But say, let's say Nag, for instance, like he had collaborations with Mishka and, you know, Plushead, and then Plushead started hooking up with Hirota. Like you have like bigger name artists, and even to this day, you have these bigger name artists that are kind of are attached to Sifubi. And that's that downstream effect for me helped out a lot. But, you know, people would say, oh, I can't afford these top tier items, or I can't even get them. They would start paying attention to like, you know, down the line of like, well, I can get this person and I like their art, and they would start, you know, they would start supporting, and then other people would see it again. So that's kind of how that all kind of started to happen.
And it's bonkers that you had that mindset, because now it's like we have you up here and they're like, I can't get his piece, but I can like now get.
But that goes to my point about like, you know, staying in this, like you just got to keep going to shows, keep submitting things, keep going forward no matter what. And maybe you'll get to a point just by being around long enough that people are like, I like this guy's stuff, or I like him personally, and whatever it may be. It's just the sticking around part.
Yeah, I think, and that's, you're absolutely right. At some point you kind of switch sales tactics too. It's less of direct to customer and this like, I have so many and we can like sell them. And then it turned into like lottery systems. And I know that you've recently had some issues with like resellers and that kind of stuff and flippers, but like, let's talk about the switch or and when you kind of had to adapt and start moving towards the lottery system.
You have to like, I mean, like for quality control reasons, you know, like I wanted to, like, I don't want to say here, like, technically I can, you know, it would have people say, oh, how come you don't just make, you know, 100, 200, whatever the hell it is of these things? Well, yeah, if I have a factory of workers doing it, sure, that's a bit more of a possibility. But like, if you get to understand like how Japanese toys are made, it's not that easy. You know, like even if I wanted to, like I'm just now at that point where like I have enough, I don't want to say pull, but like I get a little bit of priority. Because like, you know, I've been ordering for fucking 20, upwards of, you know, 15 to 20 years of stuff here. So they're like, yeah, he's consistent. Like we'll pull his vinyl. Like, you know, it's not like these, you know, vinyl factors, they don't give a shit about like the names. Like and half the bigger names, they're pulling their old vinyl anyways. Like say Hirota, he pulled his own vinyl. So he's not relying on a factory.
Let's pause just a dang minute. If you're wondering where is Toys on Tap going to be this year. We are going to Collected Con. We will be in Pasadena Designer Con. We will be at Las Vegas Designer Con. We had four shows this year that we're really excited to be a part of. Indie Toy LA happened in February, and it was an amazing show. So we're so pumped. So if you want to come say hi, come see what we're doing, come pick up work, do all the cool stuff, come see us at one of the shows. We have a booth. We would love to see you.
So, yeah, I mean, like, I wanted to keep quality control, right? So I didn't want to make these large runs. So, like, I know I can, at max, it was like 50 pieces I know I can handle perfectly. Like, if you start doing more than that, it's like, man, it takes me a solid month of literally working every single day to get this run done from, you know, again, I'm getting the vinyl in. I'm cutting all the flashing off. I'm putting it all together. I'm painting piece by piece. I'm doing the designer work for the header. I'm the one that's bagging all this stuff up. I'm doing the lottery. I'm the one that's putting it in boxes, creating labels. I'm the one that's bringing it to the post office to ship it out. Like, I'm doing every possible aspect online. And then everything, I want to make sure that the quality is top, right? Like, this way, like, when you spend your money, when you get that box in hand, you can go, this was worth the time and the money, you know? So that's where, like, you know, the lottery came in, to where it's like, all right, I know I can handle X amount. I'm going to put this out there. And then if I got more than that, well, then, you know, I have to do a lottery to make it fair to people, right? And, yeah. But, you know, so that's how that kind of came to be with that aspect of it for the lottery parts.
I will say that it is refreshing to hear that you still care about fairness. There's, I've had conversations where, like, we're dealing with it with a toy that we've produced where the artist was like, hey, I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. Like, I'd like to retire the piece, which... Okay, like, I'm all for it. Like, it's your piece. Yeah. Let's do it. And so now I'm like asking for the molds to be sent here and all kinds of stuff. And it's this, people then come back. You have fans that come back to like, why aren't you producing more? I want six or seven different variants. Mm. It's like, hey, I think for you, it's about collecting, but for the artist, it's about creating. And there's something so spiritual about that.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, you got to look at it too. Like, if you're a fan, like, you put your time and effort into supporting this artist and putting, like, I'm collecting this object, and then you go, oh, now it's over? Like, I put all my time and effort into this thing. You don't want it to be over. Then some people are cool with it, and some people are like, they can't handle that. I mean, it's just, it could be anything. It could be toys. It could be stickers. It could be fucking, you name it. It's just the one thing that they've put their energy on, and I understand that, you know? So, you know, as a fan myself, I get frustrated too. Like, there's plenty of things where, you know, like, I wanted this and now I can't get it. And like, what the hell? Like, being on both sides of the fence, I'm able to go, all right, well, you know, I get it. So like, I'm able to at least explain to people when they come asking me these kind of questions, why'd you do this or why'd you do that? Like, I have a well thought out answer behind it, because I've thought about it, why I chose to do this with this particular thing. So like, I think as long as you're open with your fan base and the artists, people will, if they're normal people, not fucking psychopaths, they'll be like, all right, I get it. And then they'll eventually, like, you can smooth it out.
Yeah. What's funny is it's like, it's always the people that have multiple versions of the thing. Like, there's a guy that I know that has every variant that has been produced of this.
That's
toy.
Dangerous. Completists.
Yeah. And like, has that. And then when we were like, after this run, we're going to retire, he was like, what the hell, man?
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I get it. I get that you want more. I get it. Yeah. But there's so much other stuff that can be produced. Let's just move on.
It's a thing. Again, it's not this. That's a problem that they have to come to terms with. You can't, again, if you were to focus your energy on trying to smooth it over for them, you're going to be doing that forever. So this is a they problem. It's not a you problem. You know, like, they have to, as a person, this is something you have to figure out on your own. You can't, they're going to try to put it on you. They're going to try to put it on the artist and blame everybody. But it's a them problem, but they have to work it out for themselves and like how to handle it as an adult. You know, you could be an adult and you can figure this out.
Yeah. I mean, and then for you being in it for this long, you've had the ability to experiment and do all these things and kind of like go through and kind of fail along the way, learn, start over, do those things. I think that's something that's, especially with someone that's been in this scene for so long, Tell me about some failures along the way as we kind of build out this NVH brand that you're doing. Things that come to mind that are like, man, I should have done this differently. So I changed it from now on.
Dude, like I have so many of those. I think the biggest one, I can go through all the little minor things, but I think the biggest one would be my work with Metacom. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I was able to work with Metacom. I kind of, you know, I wasn't ready for it, right? And in hindsight, I would have did things so much more. I would have did things so much differently. But at the time, I was kind of like trying to grow in so many different directions. I wasn't really, you know, this isn't going too far back either. This is before the pandemic. We're going to say maybe 18 or 19, where like I was, you know, like I kind of approached them and they were like, oh yeah, we will work. I was like one of those, like, you know, you're going to reach out and like, there's no way this person's going to reply to you. And then when they do, you're like, oh shit, what do I do with this kind of thing? And I got that. So I got them. When they said, okay, I'm like, all right, well, what can I do? And I, you know, that's when I came up with this, with the what I called Lash, the character that was based on the Hanya Mask logo that I made. Mm-hmm. And, I went in a completely different direction. Like I was like, I'm like the guy that makes these Safubi monsters. And it was, and then I made this mascot looking toy. And it was like what, like I really, what I was trying to accomplish was like trying to make something that didn't compete with my own toys. Right. I wanted to make something that was completely different, that, you know, that was a toy that I can have Metacom or some sell. And I wouldn't take away from my ability to, like, you don't want to sell two toys are so similar that like your fan base has to make a choice. Like, want to buy this one or that one, you know, especially in like in early days when like, you know, you don't have a whole lot to offer. You don't want to take away your only income. Right. So I was like, I came up with this idea and I'm like, I've been wanting to do something like that for a while. And then the sculptor was a very, you know, he's a very well-known sculptor in the field, done some big name stuff. And I was like, man, that's, I know who he did work for. I'm like, I would like to work with him and have him make my toy of his version. So I kind of like, you know, my biggest failure was not sticking to what my brand looked like and kind of going in a completely different opposite direction. And that really tossed people off. To me, like, yeah, things sold, but it didn't really sell like this, like any other work that I did. And it was definitely like, you know, I had people, they thought like, oh, he's working with Metacom. And it was in his head. He's this big guy. I'm like, it was behind the scenes. I'm like, I was just complete bummed out. Like, this thing was a massive, to me, a failure. Cause like I had multiple colorways picked out and they just did the one and done. And that was it. They were like, not interested to move on. They weren't rude. They were just like, thank you for your time. It was nice knowing you. So like, you know, like I had the biggest, you know, brand, you know, maker, we had Metacom, they did Cause, they did this. And I'm like, this is going to be huge for me. And then it completely went away. And I was like, I had to really like sit back and like, what do I do from here? And like, again, these are things that like, I don't post publicly. I'm like, I'm keeping this all to myself and keeping it all bottled in. Like, you know, I have people at a time going, oh, he thinks he's big time because he's working with Metacom. I'm like, man, if only you knew, but I fucking completely fucked that all up. You knew that, like, me personally, like, that was something I was struggling with, you know, like, what, I had this massive brand and then I fucked it up by like not doing what I should have did was kind of transition from the monsters that I was making something for them and then slowly evolving into something like that, which I did with Unbox when the Neo Lash toy. And I got to explore that with them. But what I should have did off the bat, I should have transitioned. And so like, you know, I have all these little mistakes I made along the line, like who I worked with, the collaborations I should have did, things I retired, which I shouldn't have retired, yada, yada, yada. But the biggest one was, I would say, the working with Metacom and fucking that up, you know. So like, everybody has these things.
That's wild, especially with Metacom. And what's funny too, is how one moment can take all the wind out of your sails, right? So it, like, your first thing is like, I got to pull back and think about what I need to do, but you're still a successful artist. Like you need to make a new toy. That's what you need to do. Like continue with the good work you were doing.
And well, this is the thing. You don't have to show people like every, you know, part of how the sausage is made, right? Like you gotta, being professional, you got to try to like try to keep your composure, try to stay out there, try to, you know, like, all right, and you know, like, as I'm kind of trying to come to terms with how to overcome what I felt was a failure, you know, move on to the next toy that I can redeem myself, so to speak, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Which that next toy, but I think we're going to finish this episode off that next toy, which kind of redeemed you. And then you, it, like, I see your work everywhere now. So take me on to the next thing that you feel kind of redeemed you.
I would say working with Headlock would be the thing that kind of redeemed me. I mean, you know, like they are like a, like Ken, he's done it all, right? He's been around for a long time, but like you still see, like I did the collaboration with him and we made the Flying Freak like with Knuckle, and it was, again, it's kind of Western. It has like, you know, that, but it redeemed me in a way, because like I was a big fan, again, I told you, like being with Hot Rods and, you know, like muscle cars, I have a Challenger, that's what so like I've been around these things, and I was a big fan of Knuckle, and then I saw that Ken was working with him. And I kind of just, I was a fan of Headlock. I remember buying their stuff at, you know, at DCon. There was like no lines. It was just like, you can walk up to the Headlock booth and buy a toy. And so I was able to go speak to Ken personally, like, hey, you know, like I see you're working, you know, working with Knuckle. Like, I'm a big fan. I pulled out, like, I have this, you know, a fan of mine. Again, oddly enough, he had Knuckle airbrush a sweatshirt in my characters. And then I ended up eventually buying that sweatshirt from that fan, from my personal collection. So I was able to say, hey, look, you know, like I'm a fan of Knuckle. He's actually painted my toys like on a shirt, like I fans. So I was able to talk to Ken, and Ken was like, well, doing a collab. So like I suggested, like, hey, we do the Flying Freak when the head I have in the DXs that seems to be doing pretty well with the fans. And Knuckle was, you know, interested in it. And then that's why he made that head for, you know, for the Headlock body. And I think with the way Ken approaches things, because it is Chinese production, he was able to make, you know, he's making runs of, they say, between 100 to 250 pieces of his toy. So I'm getting his audience to kind of, you know, see this work. And I'm, you know, I'm getting associated again now with Knuckle, which is, to me, I got to meet him for the first time just in Japan last month, which is crazy. But like, I'm a big fan of this guy. And also, like, I'm getting to work now with the people that I've been looking up to as artists for a long time. So like, to me, that was the redemption arc. Like I kept going forward. I kept looking. I'm like, you know, so that's how I end up working with Headlock. And I think Headlock, to me, like I've said this to Ken before many times, like I owe a lot to you for you exposing me to a whole new audience of collectors, you know? So these people just kind of come into your life if you're lucky, and I'm very blessed that like I've had so many opportunities to kind of work with the people that I've always dreamt of working with. Again, I don't know how this happens. And I've said this before, like, I just feel like I hit the lottery, you know, but it's, you know, it could be a million factors, but like, yeah, I think that would be to me, the arc of going from having a growing kind of toy line of my own, doing something that failed to me pretty miserably, which kind of like, you know, that's something as an artist, you have to like, how do I get past this? And then keeping it all, you know, from the world seeing me falling apart, keeping it to myself, and then finding that, you know, the other falling into this other collaboration, which I felt kind of got me back into the game again. And, you know, so that's how that happened. And that's why I feel like getting, you know, having that association with Headlock really took my brand back and brought it to a whole other level.
Yeah. Which is amazing. I kind of want to talk through, cause you are a full-time artist. So talk through the reality of like what COVID did for you as well. Cause it kind of, especially with shipping and all that stuff. If you had a toy that was on the way around March, it was over.
Yeah, it was scary. I mean, like this, I mean, I will definitely say that, like, at the very least, I keep at least 6 months worth of stock on hand, because like that was an eye-opening thing. Like, you can go, a lot of us, you know, we don't have this massive, you know, bank account where we can just order tons of vinyl. right? So you kind of just go, I'll order a month, maybe 2 months extra if you're lucky. And then after COVID came through, I was like, oh, I don't know what's going to happen here. And like, this is the only way I make money. You know, like my wife depends on me, my family depends on me. So like I started, you know, saving every fucking nickel and dime I could to buy. Every time I would buy stuff, I would just add on more stock. Excuse me, whatever I can afford. So now I have like 6 months worth of vinyl, sometimes even more, which I can like, you know, I always try to keep on hand. And then I would just, you know, whenever I had the opportunity to order more from this factory, that factory, I would just take it because it's, you know, that was just definitely a scary time. I mean, luckily for me, I mean, I had just enough orders coming kind of in right before, you know, COVID kind of really kicked in. So I was able to get these orders through. And then, you know, the same thing, like, it's not just on the artist side, like these factories depend on us too, right? Like, so like they need to have sales. So they have to like also try to figure out how do I get the stuff to my customers here. So like, thankfully, you know, the you know, Maruyama factory, what he found, you know, Yamato Shipping, which was like, you know, they were still able to ship through them. They hand off to UPS and UPS still kept running. So like you had to go through these, like, all right, now we're gonna have to try to figure out, you know, this puzzle. Like, and you know, like as a small business owner, man, like this is part of the process for all of us, right? Like you learn along the ways, you know, you get all, if you can't just jump and skip parts of this, you need to have all these pieces of your game. So, you know, when you come across a problem, how to solve it. This happens with, you know, whether it's your sculpture work, whether it's the business aspect, taxes, shipping, you name it, you have to go through it to have these answers. You can't just pass it along to somebody else, because if you don't have this knowledge, you're going to have a hole in your game, and this will eventually come back to haunt you. So like, I mean, like, I know it's tough for people, you know, especially starting out, but yeah, you have to go through this. You have to, you know, be part of it, and it will help you in the long run. You know, so all these other little things I've gone through, at least they kind of helped me know, like, all right, when COVID kicked in, I was able to like, all right, I have some stock coming. Was see what I can get to add into that. And eventually, like, you know, I talked to like this artist who talked to that artist, and he said, all right, do this. So you would just kind of start like networking and figure it out. So like, it really didn't hurt me too bad per se. I mean, like I had, you know, like after like a month into it, I speaking to all these other artists, we would like, all right, I have this amount of stock. You have this amount of stock. Could we collaborate? How can we you kind of start like trying to figure out how everybody can help each other out along the way. So
yeah.
So COVID was a problem, but it wasn't a massive problem for me.
Dude. Yeah. I mean, it was a, I didn't know, cause I wasn't making toys at this time, but I remember going to like Palos Verdes in California and you look over the ocean and all of these, like, it's one of the biggest ports in Long Beach in the United States. And so it's like all these shipping containers everywhere. Yeah. And all these like cargo ships just waiting. And it was like, now looking at that, how many of these toy makers were on those ships?
Oh man, that's crazy.
But yeah, we're approaching the next episode, which is going to be kind of more philosophical about the scene in general and all of that, and like where you fit and how that's going. And so I think this is a really good spot to stop. I know how you feel about promoting yourself and plugging it. So maybe just say goodbye to everyone. That might be helpful.
That works for me. Yeah. I mean, like I'm not the greatest at interviews. I don't think I am, at least. All right. So like, I'm talking to you and I'm having a great time. This is fun. So like, but like when I see like the view counts go up, I'm like, oh, people are actually watching this, you know? So whoever, you know, watched the last video or is watching this video, I mean, thank you for taking the time to, you know, listen to my story. You know, I find it interesting, history and whatever, like I'm involved in. So if whatever I'm saying can help anybody along with you know, their journey. I mean, I hopefully, like, I'm saying the things that are answering some questions for people that they either had or didn't think about, that this can help them think about going, you know, with their careers. So, I mean, I do want to thank the fans for taking the time to watch this video, or the last video, hopefully the next video, that, you know, and if you guys have comments, you know, leave the comments. This way we can read them, and I can, you know, address them in the next episode, or, you know, whatever comes from this in the future. You know, it's just, I mean, like, this is just the service that, like, I enjoy giving back to the fans. Man, like, you know, like, it's hard to be able to go to conventions and, you know, sell stuff, and then also be able to sign things and talk to you, and it's tough. So, I mean, the questions that you're asking me are I've been asked before, right? Like, here and there. So at least this is I'm really enjoying this, you know, way of documenting my history. Like, I've never had the opportunity to do this. So thank you for, you know, interviewing me and having this happen this way. Like, even in the future, something happens to me, my kids have something to look back and be like, this is how, you know, from my dad's own mouth, like, how this came to be. Or, you know, so it's, thank you, thank the fans, and I thank everybody for this opportunity.
Thank you for coming on for episode 2.
Thank you.